airplanes in the back. We are going to record the call, folks, and so you can go back to our websites and send this to your colleagues or what have you. So I'm just going to do a little muting, group muting, and then, folks, if you want to weigh in and ask questions or comment, you just have to press star 6. So let's just do that very quickly.
Also, one more thing to add is if you guys want to ask questions and don't want to use your voice, because this is embarrassing to talk to 100-something people, feel free to use the GoToWebinar tool in the upper right. You can type a question in, and we'll answer it along the way.
Well, that's a great idea. Martin, can you hear me okay?
I can hear you fine.
Okay. Well, let's begin for respecting those people who have shown up on time. Folks, this call is going to be a half an hour long, and this is something that we do on a regular basis. And Martin Lind, who is the Education Vertical Manager for Leads 360, is with us today. Martin also runs a number of these conference calls himself. We're doing this together. The reason that we really love working with Martin's company is because, as you know, we work in the area of best practice in post-secondary education and enrollment management, and it's absolutely crucial to go and have a software system that will capture information and report in a nimble and intelligent way. And we've reviewed so many of these software systems over the years, and when we had a look at the Leads 360 process, we got really enthused about it because it's really intuitive. So Martin, we've always enjoyed giving calls with. So that's a little summary of Martin Lind for those of you that don't know him and his company, Leads 360.
Why don't you just give a little bit about yours, a little background about you guys.
Okay.
For those who don't know.
Enrollment resources, we specialize in helping people optimize returns in enrollment management. And we focus on helping people identify low-cost, high-return ways to improve the fortunes of their schools. And we'll work with career schools, private post-secondary schools, private not-for-profit schools, and on occasion, public schools. So really, I guess it's about differences, Martin, today is the talk is how differences are interesting. And what comes to mind is, you know, what's really hot in the news the last couple of days is there's a big web internet survey or petition moving around the internet about Bert and Ernie of Sesame Street fame and the desire to have Bert and Ernie come out of the closet and get married. And, you know, really the nature, you know, those Sesame Street relationships generally don't work that well. I mean, I remember Miss Piggy, she really was abusive to Kermit, but, you know, in their relationship. But really, Martin, I guess what really is interesting about Bert and Ernie is it's really a demonstration to children about people who are opposites can actually get along.
Yeah, you know, as far as Kermit and Miss Piggy, I do think that she was abusive, absolutely, and I've heard some domestic violence claims against her. She might actually be doing time now.
I wouldn't doubt it, because she really was hard on that poor little frog.
She's a pig.
Yeah, so, but Bert and Ernie were, the storyline is that they're totally opposite, and yet they found a way to get along, and we see so much fracture, particularly in the last year or two, between traditional schools, proprietary schools like Bert and Ernie, and there's it's unfair because rather than focusing on how schools are different, the systems of education are different. Maybe the two systems can learn from one another and just really, you know, get to a place where all boats go up in a rising tide. And I think that's what we're going to focus on a little bit today, right?
Absolutely.
And now our talk's going to be a half an hour. And then we'll take questions informally at the end. And I think we're going to give away a nice little something at the end for those that are interested. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Well, let's start. Let's dive in. So really the first thing that we're looking at here, Martin, is federal regulation. So What we have up on the screen here is that traditional schools are light in terms of federal regulation, and proprietary schools are heavy in regulation. That really surprises me. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I should also say for our friends in Canada, this is U.S. federal regulation. I think that we have some Canadian schools joining in. I think that this regulation, this row might have been light and medium until about a month ago, 2 months ago. But I think it's pretty clear, at least the proprietary schools feel it's heavy regulation relative to their traditional peers.
Well, it's interesting because proprietary schools typically have federal, state, and accreditation body regulatory hoops to jump through. And I think it's seen as fair in the sense that it's a counterweight against the fact that proprietary schools make a profit. So, okay, you make a profit, you're going to be highly regulated so that it's not a piggish amount of money. And whereas traditional schools, because their mandate is to have, instead of profit, surpluses, there seem to be less of a need to regulate their affairs.
Absolutely.
Okay. So let's go to the next one.
I think this is pretty clear. I mean, in my mind, the main difference in their target market is it's adults versus kids. And it's actually, when you talk about kids, it's really the kids and their parents, whereas in the proprietary world, you're talking more to individuals and not to the whole entire family.
So just a little administrative note. On my computer, it's not showing up here.
Really?
The next little thing.
Let me make
so
sure
maybe
that
you could just
live. Oh,
just,
you know what? I take it back. We are. Is now we should. Now you're seeing it?
Not quite yet. But what's the next item? Why don't we? Why don't you just
target
read
market.
That out? Pardon?
Target market.
Target market. Okay. So with the target market, traditional and proprietary, what are we seeing there?
Now you should be seeing it. Should be on air.
There we go.
There you go. Sorry about that.
That's okay. I'm hoping everybody can see that as well. That looks very attractive. So target market, what we have here is with traditional schools. Now, these are broad-based assumptions or broad-based kind of truisms, if you will. We see a lot of recruiting at the high school level, middle class to upper, upwardly mobile families, whereas we see a fair amount of high school recruiting for proprietary career schools in particular. We also see a lot of people in their 20s, people who are working in jobs they're not happy with that want to retrain, veterans, midlife career changers. And it seems to trend towards the working class because the nature of proprietary schools tends to skew heavily towards career jobs, whereas you'll see in the traditional schools, you know, degrees in philosophy and art photography and things like that.
Yeah,
so,
I was a poli sci major, and I don't think that that's a common career school major.
Right, exactly. So it's interesting because I think what this points to is that it's really apples and oranges in a way, although there is some overlap. But what are your thoughts, Martin?
They are different people. You know, I think I started out at the beginning is by saying that the when you're trying to reach a high school, well, I think we'll get to in a minute about length of the marketing cycle. But when you're trying to get to somebody to go to your school in a traditional world, you're talking to them for a long time. You're talking to the parents. You're talking to the kid to a certain extent. But in the career side, it's one to one. It is someone making a decision for their own life.
Interesting. Okay. So what's next?
Let's get the next one.
The student's value to the school. What do you mean by that?
Right. We'd like to think that the students are individuals, but the fact is that there is a value. As a matter of fact, my schools are constantly asking me to prove my value to them with a checkbook.
Right.
They all, you know, when I was in school, they and I was a graduate student, they were trying to get me to be free labor with undergraduates. So.
No, hold on for a sec. They want you to be free labor?
Well, they were putting it as an educational opportunity, of course. It wasn't free labor. It wasn't slavery as per se, but.
So you would, when you were in your graduate program, they were using you as a teaching assistant?
They wanted me to be one, yes, absolutely.
Ah, I see. Interesting. But you chose not to.
I chose not to. I you know, graduate school, I was at University of Southern California, which is, I was much more interested in playing than I was in helping educate the younger folks.
Okay, I got it. So now on the proprietary side, the student becomes the product. Now that to me seems like a real odd statement. But, you know, I'm going to speak to that. Because proprietary schools are mandated to really place people in the workforce, they're career schools, they're outcome, it's an outcomes-driven industry. The student will become a graduate, and then a graduate will become employed in the workforce. And there is a notion, if you will, that a proprietary school, a program within a proprietary school is only as strong as the perception held by the 100 largest employers of the graduates. So stated differently, if the employer doesn't know about the school's program or doesn't find it to be of a high quality, then the school, by extension, has a weak brand. And so where, you know, the four P's of marketing, the product is important, it's particularly so in the proprietary or career school sector because those graduates are really the flag bearer for the school. Now, folks, if anybody wants to comment on that or wants to ask a question, you can do so by either typing a question into Martin or pressing *6 and weighing in and asking a question or making a comment. If you want to do that, we'd love to hear from you. Okay, Martin, let's keep rolling. Okay. How students pay.
This one is a major, obviously, this one is all the rage now.
Yeah, so basically this is a comment on stratas of economic classes. People who are in underclass economic environments or working class environments tend to have to lean quite heavily on student loans. It wasn't so bad back in the day when Sally Mae were giving loans out, and the families, if they had a Beacon score of, you know, high 500s or what have you, hey, no problem. But then, of course, with 2008, all those B-class student loans got caught in the big mess, and then Sally Mae and their friends basically went out of the industry. So now students have to rely very heavily on student loans, which is interesting, Martin, because with the federal government level and at the state government level, there's really, our understanding is there's heavy pressure to start to cut into education funding, which will affect student loans, block transfer funding at the traditional school level. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, absolutely. Not only I saw that the Pell Grants are majorly in risk, and I know that the state level grants are at risk, and as schools have less money in their endowment because they're using it for operations, the traditional schools, that is, they're going to have less money to give in scholarships. I know that it's funny, scholarships. I know that as you said at the beginning, this is kind of, these are generalized ideas in these columns, but I think there are career schools do scholarships, of course. I don't think they do sports scholarship. Have you ever run into a proprietary school, Greg, that does sports scholarships?
No, I haven't as of yet.
Yeah,
I know folks that are in the private, not-for-profit area, faith-based schools and whatnot, tend to do that. They have robust sports programs, but no, not in the career school section.
Yeah, I think it's all need-based loans. It's need-based scholarships there.
So it's interesting because I think what this speaks to is a very important change that's happening right now, and And I don't think it's an issue so much with research-based institutions where, you know, most of the revenue coming into these schools are through research activities and publishing patents and what have you. But with the teaching schools, such as junior colleges and state colleges, there's some serious issues where, in the past, these schools would receive block funding for, to say, make me 100 nurses or what have you, make me 100 BCOMs. And what's happened now is there's a trend, a disturbing trend from a school's perspective, where the school, the block funding source, say it's a state government, will come in and say, okay, did you make me 100 nurses? No, we only made you 80. Okay, give me 20% of that block funding back, please. In the past, that didn't happen, and that money would find its way into general revenue, propping up other weaker programs. So there's this trend towards program-based accountability, which is really causing concern for program leaders at the traditional school level with teaching schools, because they're saying, hey, you know, I have a background as an RN and as an educator. I didn't sign on to be a salesperson or a marketer. Come on, what gives? And so we're of the view that over the next short number of years, these teaching schools that are publicly funded will start to migrate more and more to the business tactics, the business ways of work of proprietary schools. So those of you on the call that are traditional, come from a traditional background, that might make you gag a bit, but we're of the view that's going to happen. Martin, do you care to comment on that?
Absolutely. You're right, because we have about a 95% proprietary school versus traditional school mix.
Mm-hmm.
But the traditional schools we have are their more competitive programs, you know, the adult continuing ed, online schools, those where I think we'll get to it in a little bit about the cycle, but those where they have a faster cycle and they're competing much more heavily than a traditional four-year undergrad.
Interesting. Okay, so what's next? Brand development. Interesting. Okay, so there's a school of thought that say a brand should be reserved for cattle. There's a great book called The Fall of Advertising and the Rise of PR by Al Rees that speaks to brand development. And maybe, Martin, you might want to comment on the ways in which traditional schools and proprietary schools build their brand.
Absolutely. So there's the I keep answering every question. Absolutely. I apologize, but I'm very enthusiastically agreeing with you.
Absolutely.
Absolutely, I agree with you. I think everyone knows certain schools from the news, whether it's push news or pull news. Everybody knows the school of Stanford. I think people knew it even before every tech founder came from there. John Elway played football there. People know UCLA from sports, from other events, from movies, from TV. People know Amherst, and people know the names where presidents come from and where MPs come from. That's a traditional mode. You know, that's very rarely paid. That's just out and about in the ether.
But traditional schools have a real intense, sophisticated public relations machine.
Yeah, and they occasionally advertise, but it's they're more likely to be advertised for programs that they need to fill, and that are a little less known, like their continuing ed programs or their online programs.
We also see traditional schools advertising in what's called TOMA, top of mind awareness, where it's less pick up the phone kind of advertising and more kind of creating a mood, where schools are essentially buying their frequency through TV, large newspapers, what have you. And now it says proprietary schools build their brand through employer approval. That to me seems like an odd statement.
Well, it's your statement, so why don't you follow up on it?
Okay,
but it makes
I think
sense.
I will. Thank you.
It kind of goes along with what you said before, right? The student becomes the product.
That's right. Yeah, So it's a real harsh reality, but when you're training people to build a career, it all ties into placement. And a group of us have all been saying that the battleground over the next few years, the most important aspect of career-oriented post-secondary education is placement. Because if you can't place those graduates, well, first of all, for proprietary schools, they lose their license. But in a broader scheme, it just creates a really weak brand in this sector. So again, you're only as strong as how, the perception of your employers that hire your grads, which again really forces people who are in a career school framework to have a fantastic product. Because if the product is not fantastic, they're out of business.
They're out of business, and first they'll get the bad name, and then they'll lose their federal funding, at least in the United States. So
Just
it can
bad,
get
bad,
worse and
bad.
worse.
Yeah, it's all bad. Positioning. Okay. Have you ever been on a repositioning cruise?
Sounds
Twenty
painful.
20 cents on the dollar. Yeah, go backwards on a cruise ship. But that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about education. So positioning. So traditional schools are historically around higher learning, newer thinking, generating new ideas and thoughts, which lead to innovation, research development, technology transfer. The public schools that are teaching universities are in a vulnerable spot because they don't really engage in much of that at all. And they're getting attacked by block funding sources. So they're kind of in between the proprietary school model and the research university model. Positioning for proprietary schools tend to be skill building for a career. Now, of course, there are private schools that are offering bachelor's degrees and master's programs, but there seems to still be a very strong orientation about building that career.
It's true. There's a, you know, one of the things this exercise made me think about was it wasn't that long ago, I want to say about 3 months ago, that University of Phoenix sponsored an NBC symposium, I want to say. It might have even been telecast, but it was a symposium in Los Angeles and maybe nationwide about the future of education. And Phoenix was branded all over it. And Phoenix does, of course, offer non-career, more traditional type degrees like bachelor's and sciences, bachelor's in arts.
Well,
So,
Phoenix started their whole process in the 70s as a training ground for nurses and firefighters. So, it's interesting.
yeah.
Okay, so let's move on to our next point here. Sources of lead generation traffic. Okay, so now we're going to dig into some more technical marketing aspects. So, tell me what your thoughts are here.
Yeah, I you know, you just we've had children and friends and ourselves go through the recruiting process for traditional schools and to a certain extent for the career schools. And the traditional schools reach out, you know, to high school kids and send it catalogs, go to high school fairs. And the way they get the catalogs and your information is from the testing services. They expect you to know their name because if you're in Ohio, everyone knows Ohio State. And if you're in Los Angeles, everyone knows UCLA. You know, they expect you to know it, and you go after them.
So it's really, I guess and then with proprietary schools, it's really more real heavy leaning on direct response tactics, and the young people hang out on the internet, and that's where people seem to spend a lot of their effort. And then, of course, television seems to be a secondary but prominent tool. And then what's interesting is far and away the highest converting leads are through referral. And that seems to be developing as an emerging tactic in building and enrollment figures. But I guess what comes up for me on this one, Martin, is that the traditional schools use multiple prongs, multiple tactics in marketing, but tend to be more benign or gentle around asking people to take a next step. Whereas with proprietary schools, they tend to be more singular in their lead generation, and then tend to be more service oriented, or you know, a negative person would say aggressive in asking people to take the next step, pick up the phone, get your free career starter kit, come in for an interview. Whereas I know my experience in having, for instance, my daughter go to a fairly well-established traditional school, she got bombed with letters, websites, here's your password, check this out, here's a catalog, but nobody reached out to her at all. She had to do it all on her own.
Dear prospect, we would like to let you know about our school, school name.
Yeah, that's right. Kind of a boilerplate.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you were to be cynical, you could say that the worst of the proprietary schools are over-aggressive, and the worst of the traditional schools are abusive through benign neglect. And then, of course, they're, most of them are really good in both areas. So,
well, one of the things that I was thinking of when we talked about this was something I think I read it in one of the Inside Higher Ed, or it might have been a webinar I attended, but somebody pointed out that the inability to expand a school's class or a school's size is a badge of honor at a traditional school. So versus the ability to expand at a proprietary school to meet the demand is a badge of honor for them.
So, interesting.
Yeah, if Harvard never sends out one catalog and doesn't reply to one piece of mail, and they don't make one phone call, they're still going to have a 20% acceptance rate or 30% acceptance rate, and that's not how the proprietary schools operate. That's not their belief.
Well, and it's they can't work to that economic reality. Now, what's interesting though is that the teaching schools, the traditional schools that are strictly teaching schools, where they have a high degree of revenue coming in via enrollment, are going to be really up against it, where they're going to have to start to hold their nose, if you will. And I say hold their nose because we've spoken to so many people in this region, and I don't know if snob is the right word, but there's kind of a looking down upon the private career school folks, and like, be careful what you wish for, I guess, is really what comes to mind, because the traditional schools that do not have a research and development technology transfer piece to their mix are going to be moving in that direction, whether they like it or not. What's next?
Absolutely. You know, Greg, we're at the time, but we have some questions. Do you want to just finish through the slides and then we'll ask the questions at the end?
That's a great idea. Yeah, we want to respect people's time. Folks, this is just a half an hour conference call, because we don't want to, you all have busy days. What we're going to be doing is we've recorded this. We're going to make it available via website and a little MP3 file. And we're also going to have speaker's notes from here. And then we are going to be, we have another 15 of these that we're going to be sharing with you, but we're going to do it at the end of August. So we'll have a follow-up at the end of August. Now, the other thing is, Martin, I'd be, we're offering a little gift, and we have a review, and this is a best practices review on enrollment management, and usually this is a little $500 assessment, and for the first 5 people that phone Paul after the meeting or text in, you'll receive this for free if you want to see how you're comparing to best practice, either in the area of lead generation or lead conversion. And this could be either for traditional schools or proprietary schools. And then after that's completed, then if you wish, you can have a free, no-holds-barred trial of Leeds 360 software system, which is very skookum. How we put that into play is there are just 2 numbers. If you want to text, you text in 250-888-7111, 250-888-7111, and we'll just make sure that we get that for you. Or if you want to phone Paul, it's Paul. Paul's number is 250-391-9494, 250-391-9494. And again, what you receive is a free best practices review combined with a free no-holds-barred trial of the Leads 360 system for a nice chunk of time. So that's the pitch. That's all the pitches today, folks. Don't worry. We're
okay, let's go back
you.
To the slides then and finish up, and we'll do the questions at the end.
Yeah, you bet.
The nature of media buy.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Top-of-mind awareness ads are tend to be the preponderance of traditional schools, whereas direct response is proprietary. Do you want to just comment to the folks what top-of-mind awareness ads are all about?
Sure. It's just keep us in mind. Don't go to the program. Don't do any. There's no call to action, right?
Okay. So this is the traditional ad agency model where they say you want to just be people walking down the street. You want to be continually bumping in to the offer, and then one day when you're ready to go, the school is at the top of their mind. So this is a traditional way that people have run advertising. But then with the advent of search engines, became search engine marketing, which essentially the Internet is the largest direct response marketplace ever in the history of man. And so, Martin, I guess direct response marketing really is that kind of advertising, you don't really care about your image or building your brand. Really, all you care about is getting people to pick up the phone, and then you worry about building your brand and your image in the sales or the admissions process. Would that be fair?
Totally.
Yeah, so to summarize, with proprietary schools, they tend to want to build their brand or their influence in the admissions process, whereas with traditional schools, they tend to want to build their brand or their influence prior to people entering the process. And not to say either one is good nor bad, but they're definitely different approaches. Interesting, hey?
Yep.
Okay, so we're on time. Let's do class starts per year, and then we'll just see if anybody has any comments or questions. So class starts per year is usually 3 per year, with September being the major start.
I think that's, and it's probably, when you say 90-95% start in September?
I'd say, yeah.
Yeah,
that's right. And whereas with proprietary schools, quarterly, weekly, daily, often there's modular curriculum and asynchronous online programs, all kinds of innovation around start dates so that people can get going right away with their education. So that's interesting.
Yeah.
Now, does anybody have any comments or any questions? If you do, you just have to press star 6. If you want to come and take over this conference call at the very end here, you just have to press star 6. And
you've got a bunch of questions queued up on GoToWebinar.
Okay, well, let's start with those, okay? And then if anybody wants to chime in, they could just press star 6. Now, folks, it is a half an hour, so for those that have a tight time deadline, you just you can take off, and we'll get you some speaker notes or get you the free offer at a later point. But let's hang now for some informal questions, some Q&A, okay?
Sure. The question came in saying, Tiny asked the question saying, you're predicting that state and federal funding will go down. Does this lead you to believe that debt loads for not-for-profit schools will go up?
That's a good question. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think it's inevitable, especially, as traditional schools, non-for-profit schools are getting less and less funding. There's no choice but to raise their prices. I mean, I talked to friends of ours who are now sophomores at a big UC school, and they're California residents. It should be affordable, and it is. They're paying a ridiculous amount of money to go to a state school as a California resident.
Right. So basically, what happens is with basic economics, microeconomics, if the funding contracts, like most people don't really realize that, well, say a junior college is offering a one-year program and a career schools offering a one-year program. The tuition with the proprietary schools generally double. And so what happens is the traditional school, the junior college, it's being supplemented by the taxpayer. And now what's happening with all the stuff in the news at the federal level, that committee of 12 now are looking for $1.5 trillion in reductions, and it's got to go deeper. That's what most people don't realize. It has to move beyond $1 trillion because this is just to chew out the money out of the debt. Now, the annual deficit at the federal government level is almost $1 trillion. It's $900-odd billion. They've got to move that. There's a lot of political pressure to move to a balanced budget. Where is that $1 trillion going to come from every year? Now, stack in state funding, which is a huge source of funding for post-secondary schools at the state level. Those people are, if you look at the monies owed or the deficit and debt as a percentage of the state economies, like California and what have you, a lot of these states you would actually say are bankrupt. You get states such as Texas that run a balanced budget program. Last spring, they had 4 community colleges on notice that they were going to be shut down they could not achieve a balanced budget.
And it's funny you should mention Texas. I just was reading the paper this morning that the reason Texas had a balanced budget the last 2 years was because of the federal stimulus money that came in to balance their budget 2 years in a row. So if they hadn't, those schools would have disappeared already. And who knows what the tuition at University of Texas and all the community schools would be at.
So we think that what will happen is with the combination of the federal transfer payments reducing combined with the state deficits and debt, that there will be that post-secondary education will be one of the target areas for reduction. Now, that will happen in 2 areas. It will happen in block transfer funding, and it will happen in tightening up student loan requirements. And either way, it's not good. So
no.
The way you battle that is by really getting really laser-like around your product. A relevant product, a high-quality product, will always succeed in the market. And I think what's happened, a lot of schools have gotten flabby because they've been propped up.
No question about it.
Okay, next question.
A question from Anna. Can you please suggest some ways to build relationships with employers to promote school brand?
Sure. Can I weigh in on that one, Martin?
Please, you start.
Okay. So here's the way you do this. So the question is, how do we go and build relationships with employers? Now, the key is to do it efficiently. So here's how you do it. You go into LinkedIn, and you find discussion forums or groups that line up with your offering. You join the groups. And then what you do is you go to the owner of the group and you offer to run the job board. Every group has a job board in LinkedIn. And you take it over. If you're in San Francisco, go to the San Francisco Chamber of Commerce or Board of Trade LinkedIn group. There will be several thousand employers in that group. And then you go and say, I'd like to go and manage your job board. And so basically what you're offering is a free job board within these LinkedIn groups, and it's an extremely effective way to put more trout in the trout pond, so to speak, to get your school in front of hundreds and hundreds of employers that otherwise wouldn't know that you existed by simply taking leadership in LinkedIn groups. Martin, you care to add in there?
That was a great suggestion. The only one that our schools ever suggest to me is they usually use the old shoe leather, going to the neighboring, if they do allied health type education, they'll go to all the neighboring doctor's offices to make sure that the offices are aware of the skills and that they're providing their students.
Excellent. That's another good idea. Okay, any more questions there?
Another question from Tiny. Do you see some other form of validation coming for higher ed other than hiring career statistics, particularly in the for-profit space?
So I'm not sure what that question means. Tiny could jump on.
The question, I think what happened was we talked about brand development and value to school comes from the student being successful.
Yes.
And so the question is, do you see other forms of validation coming other than hiring and career statistics?
This is Tiny. You guys said that the student becomes the product, i.e. it is the validation of the school's brand and its ability to exist. Do you see in the future either that becoming the traditional school's the traditional school's brand, so to speak, or reputation, or do you see some other form of validation coming into play?
That's a great question. I'll take a crack at that. I think it's tied, the programming from where I sit, this is a personal view, it comes in at three levels. There's a hardcore career orientation. I'm going to train to be a phlebotomist. I'm going to train to be an IT programmer. Then there are what I would call a career orientation where you go to get a BCom or an associate degree in marketing, or you go to become, you get a law degree, where it's thinking oriented. It is, there's a lot of historical new thinking, but it really is on a broad career path. And then there, of course, are the degrees such as English, philosophy, anthropology, geography, which are really high quality learning experiences, but really there's not a direct, Martin, you kind of went through that stream, didn't you? You had a degree in, what was that, abstract physics? Or
I wish it was abstract physics. That'd be much more employable. You know, when you graduate from traditional school, the promise is that we taught this guy to think. But occasionally, of course, you get a degree that teaches you something like an accounting degree. But you also have to take your Russian literature or your you know, French revolutionary history class that doesn't have a huge amount of practical impact on the career world, other than the fact that you can write essays, do research, and talk. So the value, the school's value can be measured in Nobel Prizes, maybe, or in people who have become consultants because they can write and think, versus the income and the hireability of their employees. I was not, you know, graduating with a poli-sci degree, what did I know coming out of college?
Well, what they say, the difference between a poli-sci degree and a large pizza is a large pizza will feed a family of four. So, but back to Tiny's question, you know, I'm kind of skirting around the edges of it because, you know, I think I don't know. I mean, it's really a no-brainer where you train somebody to become an IT person, they perform well, it reflects well in the school. You teach somebody at a state college to think well and to come out with a BCom, the correlation is mushy. And, you know, I don't have a smart answer for you there, Tiny, from my perspective. I do think, though, that with the constraints that are going to be foisted upon particularly the traditional teaching schools, that it's absolutely crucial that these schools are cutting edge and the product is absolutely at the front, at the bleeding edge, and there has, if any deans or department heads have been slack in staying on top of curriculum or trends in education or learning, they're going to get squeezed out. So, Tiny, I don't have a smart answer. Does anybody else on the call want to weigh in on Tiny's question? I think it's a really good question that doesn't have a clear answer. Okay. What's next, Martin?
Well,
anything else?
That's the last of the questions. So since we still have 35 people listening in, should we also just run through the last of the rows?
Yeah, let me just try and make everybody unmute here.
Thank you. You guys have been awesome.
tengo mucha suerte.
Great. Greg.
Mira, vamos a dividirlos entonces. Estoy acabando con un webinar ahora.
Greg, did we lose you?